If you're like me, you have not heard of the Transition Initiative movement or the Transition Town movement. It's something that I didn't know about until I met with three very remarkable church members. A month and a half ago or 2 months ago, I lose track of time, Rose Liu, Brian Woodruff, and Alex Barnett came to see me about the Transition Initiative. There is a transition movement in Fort Collins, and now I'm happy to say that through the work of these individuals, there is a transition movement that is part of the Social Justice Council of the Foothills Unitarian Church. At the end of the service today, I'll be telling you what is coming next. But to introduce the transition movement, I suppose I should use one word: resilience. It's familiar to ecologists, but it refers to the ability of a system, from individual people to whole economies, to hold together and maintain their ability to function in the face of change and shocks from the outside. This book, which is available at the Fort Collins Library, is called The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependency to Local Resilience. It's written by an individual named Rob Hopkins, who is the founder of the transition movement. But the transition movement is truly democratic. It truly involves many, many people, more and more all over the world. Rob Hopkins wrote that, over the last year or so, I have become what one might call a voracious vision harvester. I really like that language, because what he's talking about is that we all have visions of what the future might be. And many of them are dystopian. They're dystopian in our science. They're dystopian in our novels. As a vision harvester, Rob Hopkins is looking at a different vision of what the future might be, a future that we will make together, make or break together. So as our first speaker this morning, to share some of her journey, I've asked Rose Liu to talk with us. But first, before Rose speaks, hit it, Joni.
So they paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging night spot. Don't it always seem as though that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Put them in a tree museum, and they charged all the people an arm and a leg just to see. Don't it always seem to know that you don't know what you got till it's gone? To pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
In 1970, the year of the first Earth Day, Joni Mitchell wrote Big Yellow Taxi, a song of love, loss, and protest. I think these feelings are at the heart of the human condition and the root of our strivings to improve it. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away your DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees. Please. My own lost love was the ocean. I spent the best part of my childhood summers at the eastern shore of the Long Island Sound. My aunt and uncle owned a turn-of-the-century farmhouse where our extended family vacationed. I went swimming, beachcombing, birding, clamming, fishing, exploring with my cousins. It was a magical place. I remember swimming at night and the trail of phosphorescent plankton, the softly blinking fireflies against the cliff, the Milky Way brilliant, far from city lights. The ocean was also my first ecology teacher. When tar balls began to wash up on the beautiful stony shore in the 60s, I was indignant. I learned it was from ocean dumping. When the rare stinging jellyfish became so common by August that you could not swim, I was alarmed. I learned the ocean had warmed and the jellyfish were expanding their range. The osprey, those amazing fish hawks, became rare. I would learn it was from DDT. Our clamming areas closed, contaminated by septic system sewage from housing developments sprouting up all over the shallow aquifers. At my home, Woodland Road became a woodland in name only. The fields and woods I had roamed were paved over, replaced by apartments, the Greenacre shopping mall, and hot, smelly asphalt. Yes, they paved paradise and put up parking lots. So when the first Earth Day erupted in 1970, I was ready. My high school class cleaned the detritus of our throwaway society out of our local stream. 20 million Americans, 10% of our population, took to the streets, parks, and auditoriums to demonstrate for a healthy, sustainable environment. College students organized protests. Diverse groups found common cause. Many recognized our individual responsibilities for contributing to environmental problems. As Pogo observed, we have met the enemy, and they are us. We all, 20 million of us, made a difference. Precedent-setting environmental protection laws were passed. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency was created under a reluctant President Nixon. When Jimmy Carter was elected, he put solar panels on the White House and set up a commission to develop a national solar energy policy. In 1979, I headed off to the School of Public and Environmental Affairs in Bloomington, Indiana, determined to be part of the next decade of huge environmental progress. But an ideological backlash had begun as soon as the EPA was created, orchestrated by a powerful few who did not like government or its interfering with industry and did not want to pay for environmental or public health protection. In 1980, they won. Ronald Reagan was elected president. People liked this actor with his reassuring "It's Morning in America" ads, who said we had too much government and too much taxes. Down came the solar panels. The national solar energy policy was abandoned. The solar industry and its green jobs lost. Reagan said trees were the main source of air pollution, not industry or burning fossil fuels. He appointed Ann Burford to dismantle the work of the EPA and James Watt to give away our public land resources at the Department of the Interior. But taxes on the wealthy were slashed. We had a severe depression. In 2000, when Bush II was anointed president by the now right-wing Supreme Court, his administration picked up where Reagan's had left off. I had a ringside seat for part of this political circus, working with the Park Service in Everglades National Park, 1980 to 1981, and with the EPA from 1987 to 1999. The Reagan and Bush II administration set environmental progress back at least 20 years. Dick Cheney's national energy policy, written by and for the oil industry, oil and gas industries, behind closed doors, ensured continued dependence on fossil fuels and accelerating global warming. It exempted fracking from the Clean Water and Safe Drinking Water Acts, leading it to its explosion all over the country. Political doublespeak, like the Clean Skies Initiative that increased air pollution, and anti-democratic, ill-informed policy became the norm. The transition movement is about a sustainable future. The branding is new, but its roots are in science and calls to action that began over six decades ago. Aldo Leopold's classic Sand County Almanac was published in 1949. It called for a land ethic, an ecological conscience, to help us live on our land without ruining it. Rachel Carson, a biologist, wrote Silent Spring in 1962. She wanted to warn people that the indiscriminate use of pesticides was poisoning our food chain and killing our songbirds. Barry Commoner wrote The Closing Circle in 1971. He explained the unintended consequences of our nuclear age and industrialization. Man had broken nature's sustainable energy, water, and nutrient cycles, and we needed to fix that. The latest Nation magazine editorial, Save Earth Day, calls for another Earth Day just like the first. I hope that happens. But at least in Fort Collins, Earth Day 2012 was abuzz with people taking environmental sustainability efforts back into their own hands. There is still no time like the present for change. But we've learned we can't just wait for government to act. The Union of Concerned Scientists will launch the Institute for Science and Democracy this May to help bring science back into government. And we citizens need to think global and act local more than ever before. Transition Fort Collins is a great place to start. As Dr. Seuss said in The Lorax, written after the first day, Earth Day, unless people like you care a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not.
Thank you, Ryan. Brian Woodruff has been a part of our church community for many years now. Brian was involved in the church before I arrived in 1991, and his presence not only in the church but also in the city of Fort Collins has been significant. I asked all of our three speakers this morning to not only share with us information about the transition movement, but also to tell a little bit of their own personal story, because their personal stories are reflected in our own journeys as well. Brian?
I want to tell you about a series of wake-up calls that got me involved in the transition movement. The first was in 1972, when a little book called Limits to Growth began making headlines. It was the first major scientific study to challenge an assumption that economic growth would continue uninterrupted into the future. The idea was heresy at that time, and it still is. Growth is virtually the sole index of national economic well-being. But the authors had concluded that the end of growth would probably arrive between 2010 and 2050 if nothing were done to prevent it. Industrial output and food production at that time would begin to fall, leading to a decline in population. Many did not want to accept this, and pro-business interests waged a debunking campaign to discredit its findings. They succeeded in blurring the picture, but 40 years later, its projections are holding up quite well. I encountered limits to growth at age 24, and it woke me up to the fact that the world that I had been born in, raised in, and educated was headed towards what the book politely called an historic discontinuity. But in plainer language, it would mean collapse, or going over a cliff, or hitting a brick wall. As a wake-up call, it was about as gentle as a bucket of cold water on my head. I felt worried and overwhelmed. How could we change this? So, as humans often do, I resorted to the comfort and safety of denial. Someone would surely fix it, perhaps science or technology or the free market. In other words, I went back to sleep. My second big wake-up call was a 1998 article in Scientific American about the inevitable peaking of world oil supply. Although it is widely misunderstood, oil geologists and production managers have a basic observation about the oil extraction business, that production rate increases to a peak when about half of the resource has been extracted, and then begins an irreversible terminal decline. And this observation applies not only to individual oil wells, but also to nations. Our own U.S. oil production peaked in 1971. As of 2009, 40 more oil-producing nations have passed their peaks, and inevitably the same will happen to total world oil production. After that, we will have less and less oil production each year, and the price of gasoline will skyrocket. The wake-up call for me was this. Oil production was going to be the first non-negotiable limit to growth. We would not run out of oil, but we would run out of cheap oil. I began to realize that oil plays a leading role in our economy, and we have based our lifestyle on the assumption that we will always have cheap oil. Almost all transportation, cars, trucks, buses, trains, airplanes, and ships, all are designed to burn liquid fuels. Our food supply, living in a suburban setting, and market globalization, all of these depend on cheap oil. These revelations had an enormous impact on me. The next 10 years will be very different than the last 10, and we are not prepared for the changes. What would you do if fuel became hard to get, either because it was too expensive or because of intermittent shortages? I became preoccupied with what people call the Mad Max scenario. What could happen if Americans, who feel entitled to cheap fuel, are given neither warning nor a truthful explanation why the price of gasoline has gone astronomical, and they have made no arrangements to handle their predicament? I worried that the actions of frightened, desperate, angry people could bring about the end of civil society. I was deeply troubled by it. I wanted to learn more, so I went to a conference on peak oil in my adopted hometown of Yellow Springs, Ohio. I listened to speakers and workshops exploring the consequences of peak oil for communities and what we could do about it. But I noticed something surprising in these serious discussions. And this was perhaps the biggest wake-up call of all. why were these people smiling? I met people who had accepted that living with less fossil fuel energy is inevitable and had started to think about how their families and communities could survive and even thrive with less energy. Back in Fort Collins, my friend Cheryl DeStasso said to me, "Brian, if you're concerned about peak oil, then you need to read the Transition Handbook. It's about people who are doing something about it." I think I read that book in a single day. It was like sweet, cool water to a thirsty man. Transition frames the issues in terms of people taking action in their communities to create the future that they want to live into. Local resilience and self-reliance and relocalization of the economy are the keys. And what could be more positive than engaging members of my community to plan? How shall we co-create a livable and enjoyable future? Transition also reminds me that what makes me happy and fulfilled has almost nothing to do with a consumer lifestyle or abundant cheap energy. I am fulfilled being in my family and community, feeling personal autonomy and empowerment, finding satisfaction in honest work well done. Yes, we will have less energy, but there are many beautiful and necessary things that we are not running out of. Human love, music and art, the beauty of nature, and the ingenuity and creative genius of the people. We can use all of this abundance in the process of coming together and finding solutions that will help us survive and thrive in the future. I hope that you will take time to learn a little bit more about transition. We don't know if it will work, because transition is a social experiment on a massive scale. What we are convinced of is this: if we wait for the governments, it will be too little too late. If we act as individuals, it will be too little. But if we act in community, it might be just enough, just in time.
Thank you very much, Brian. I'm going to invite the congregation to join together and rise in body or in spirit. We're going to sing hymn number 351, which seems an appropriate. Well, I remember the way the piece of church ground used to look. Every summertime, the weeds would grow higher and higher near our parking lot in that direction. And every summer, we would hire someone to come and mow the weeds down. The city of Fort Collins wasn't terribly pleased all the time with how high those weeds grew. Alex Barnett was one of the people who had a vision for how we might change the utilization of church property. And so the organic garden came into being, and it has grown and grown, involving more and more church members, making produce available to not only church members, but also to local community organizations. There was a vision, there was a dream. The sea winds blew, the prairie grass grew, and the organic garden is true. Alex Barnett.
Why do we need a transition movement? The simple answer is, we are destroying the earth, and if we care about future generations, we need to do something else. We've got big, complex problems. These problems are summarized by the three D's: depletion, debt, disaster. Depletion refers to the dwindling resources of a finite planet. We're running out of cheap oil, and many other resources are in peril, such as fresh water, topsoil, biodiversity, forests, ocean fisheries. Debt is the second D. Globalization, cheap oil, and ever-increasing debt has powered our economy for years. But the party's over and the bills are coming due. The recession of 2008 may not be temporary, but one of a long series of cyclical recessions. The end of growth may be the new normal. Disaster is the third D. As we try to protect and replace cheap oil with ideas like unfunded resource wars, fracking, nuclear power, and deep water drilling, we bring on environmental disasters. The costs of dealing with these disasters adds to our mounting debt. It's easy to feel overwhelmed thinking about the scope of our problems. The human brain is conditioned to take action when threatened with immediate danger. We don't do so well with complex, multi-generational problems like climate change. We also have a finite pool of worry and can only deal with so much. It's hard to hold long-term dangers like peak oil and vanishing species in our mind when there's always more immediate problems, like being late for work, or a sick child, or another errand to run. The transition movement is a community-level response to these big problems. By working together to build resilience in our local community, we reconnect with each other and the earth that sustains us. We need to transition to a different way of thinking and living. If not for us, than for our children. Anne Lamott, a writer and activist, puts it clearly. We're supposed to do what people of conscience and heart and hope have always tried to do. We're supposed to try and save the world, make the world safer for the children, a little bit sweeter. So what's my story? Why am I here? I was born in 1951 in Washington, D.C. When I was a young boy, my family lived in a new subdivision in Wheaton, Maryland. I was 5 years old and beginning to understand there was more to the world than my backyard. I remember going on what seemed at the time a great journey. I traveled to a patch of woods, which in fact was only 3 blocks from my house. But the hike seemed to take forever, and the vistas down unfamiliar streets were new to me, like undiscovered country. The brook was not visible from the road. I had to crawl under trees and bushes to reach it. Though only 6 inches deep and easily stepped over, this brook was a magical place for me. Shaded by trees, stray sunbeams lit the gurgling water. I was lost in this peaceful place. I watched minnows in the pooled water and discovered crayfish. When I came home as the triumphant explorer, I felt content. I don't know how long it was before I made the journey again. Perhaps it was the next summer. But when I came back to the woods and the brook, I found they were gone. All I saw was bulldozed earth. No trees, no bushes. Where the brook had been was a huge metal culvert. Shocked, I came home feeling a loss I was unable to put into words. This was my first taste of disaster, a wounding of our earth registered in my early memories. As I grew older, I could have talked with my father about this, but didn't. He was an economics professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He had recently written a book called Scarcity and Growth, which argued that resource depletion did not threaten economic growth. He died in 1987 and did not live to see my children or how degraded the state of our planet has become in the last 25 years. In the span of three generations, from my father to my children, we have come to what is perhaps the defining issue of our time. How will we make the Earth a hospitable place for future generations? Groucho Marx had a different view. Why should we bother about the next generation? They've never done anything for us. I have three sons. My kids used to go to camp each summer at Camp Chief Ouray near Granby. I drove them over Trail Ridge Road, and over a period of perhaps 7 years, I watched whole mountainsides of trees die, millions of trees. Warming temperatures and stress from drought allowed mountain pine beetle populations to swell and kill thousands of acres of pine. The camp looks now to be situated in a clear cut. The camp counselors were upbeat. We planted new trees, they'll grow back. But after a disaster, we tried to adapt and make the best of it. But how do we adapt to a Fukushima or a BP Gulf oil spill? If our children are to have a better world, we need to tell some new stories. And transition is one of those stories. Rob Hopkins, the founder of Transition, says, "Inherent within the challenges of peak oil and climate change is the opportunity for a social, economic, and cultural renaissance, the likes of which we've never really dreamed of before." I'm drawn to Transition because I feel connected to other like-minded people. I'm not so afraid or alone when we work together on these big, daunting problems. Transition is a place where I can care about the Earth, find connection, and do something positive. So who's the hero of our story? Will government and politicians get us out of this mess? Will corporations responsibly manage our planet's resources? Will technology save the day? Thomas Paine lived in troubled times in 1776, in the midst of a transition from a colony to an independent nation. He said, "I prefer peace, but if trouble must come, let it come in my time so that my children can live in peace." We are the heroes of the story, each one of us. We have to save ourselves. Each of you has ideas and passion and a story that is unfolding. What choices will you make in the narrative of your life? What will you do to make the world safer and a little sweeter for our children? Don't let your ideas die. Don't let life push you down. Bring those ideas and help plan the transition. You may not change the world, but you can change your world. Thank
you. Thank you, Alex, and indeed, thanks to Rose and Brian and Alex for a very thought-provoking and challenging morning. They will be available at a table in the social hall following our service to give you more information about the transition movement. What next?